Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Emilio San Pedro, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 4th of December, these are our main stories. An eagerly awaited report by the congressional panel leading the U.S. impeachment inquiry into President Trump says it's uncovered overwhelming evidence that he abused his powers. Once approved, the report will be handed to the Judiciary Committee, which can then draft articles of impeachment. And researchers have developed artificial neurons which could help patients overcome disease or paralysis. Also, as we record this podcast, NATO leaders are preparing for a second day of celebrations to mark the alliance's 70th anniversary. But some of the key members are unhappy. Does one of the world's most successful military alliances have a future?
I think they will sit around that table and see that actually they share far more together than the things that divide them. And that given the state of the world, we're much better off with NATO than without it.
But first to Washington, where after weeks of testimony from White House insiders, Democrats in the U.S. Congress have made their case for the impeachment of Donald Trump. Adam Schiff is chair of the Congressional Intelligence Committee, which has overseen the impeachment investigation.
This report chronicles a scheme by the President of the United States to coerce an ally, Ukraine, into doing the president's political dirty work. And he was willing to sacrifice the national security of the United States by withholding military aid and diplomatic recognition in the form of that White House meeting in order to get what he wanted.
Our correspondent in Washington is Chris Buckler.
Truthfully, Emilio, a lot of what was said in those public hearings is put together here. There's a lot of what people know, and it's summed up pretty much in the opening statement of this report, in which it says that as far as the Democrats are concerned, they've uncovered a long effort by President Trump to use the powers of his office to solicit foreign interference on his behalf in the 2020 election. But truthfully, when you look at this, it's 300 pages that goes through in forensic detail, setting out these allegations that President Trump basically said to Ukraine, as far as the Democrats are concerned, that if you don't launch investigations into my political opponents, then potentially we could withdraw military aid, or alternatively, we might not give you a visit to the White House. That is the central allegation in all of this, but it is all spelt out in forensic detail. And there is some stuff that we didn't know before. For example, there are allegations about phone calls and contact between, among others, the president's own personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, and what's known as the Office of Management and Budget. That's the government department that did for a while withhold that money, that hundreds of millions of dollars of military aid to Ukraine.
But Washington is a very polarized place these days. So how has the White House responded?
Yeah, to say the least, it is polarized. I mean, the president keeps on talking about this being a witch hunt, but there is a pretty stark statement from the White House who call this a one-sided sham and go on to say that Mr. Schiff's report reads like the ramblings of a basement blog, straining to prove something when there is evidence of nothing. It gives you that idea that the White House is lining up its defense and basically saying that this is worth nothing. And actually, Republicans have even put together their own report that essentially says that actually what they heard cleared the president.
And where do we go from here then?
Well, basically, it is now handed over to the Judiciary Committee. There has to be a vote that takes place that basically means the report goes to the Judiciary Committee and they draw up what are known as articles of impeachment. Those are basically the charges against the president. And from there, it's a full vote in the House of Representatives that could see a Senate trial as early as January. That's right at the start of another election year.
Chris Buckler. As we record this podcast, the founders of the U.S. tech giant Google have announced they're leaving their roles at the company. Larry Page and Sergey Brin said in a news release that they would step down from their leadership roles at Google's parent company, Alphabet. We've never been ones to hold on to management roles when we think there's a better way to run the company, the pair wrote. The current CEO of Google, Sundar Pichai, will take the reins at Alphabet as well. Our correspondent in Silicon Valley is Dave Lee.
They haven't quite left the company completely, I should be clear about. They've simply stepped down as CEO and president. Larry Page was the CEO and Sergey Brin was the president of Alphabet. Now, Alphabet is the parent company of Google, and that was a company set up to achieve two things. One, it meant Page and Brin could take a step aside from running Google day to day and instead focus on different projects like self-driving cars and internet balloons and all the crazy things Google does. And also it was going to give more transparency to Google's investors about which parts of the business were making money and which weren't. And, you know, since that was set up in 2015, Page and Brin have taken a big back seat, really, on all the runnings of Google. Whenever you see Google represented, whether it's in Congress or talking to investors, it is Sundar Pichai, the CEO of Google, who is now going to become the CEO of Alphabet as well. And so this won't change much about the company day to day, but it is the most significant sort of leadership change since Google was founded, really. This will be the first time where Page and Brin don't have an executive position that is dealing specifically with management, although it is worth stressing they will still be the most powerful shareholders on Alphabet's board. And so while Sundar Pichai will be in charge of Alphabet as CEO, Page and Brin may still have the final say on exactly what it does.
Dave Lee. Back here in London, NATO leaders are preparing for a second day of celebrations to mark the alliance's 70th anniversary. On day one, Tuesday, they didn't appear to be in the mood for celebration at all. President Trump accused his French counterpart Emmanuel Macron of being nasty and disrespectful for describing NATO as brain dead. Mr. Macron defended his comments and again criticized the Turkish president Recep Tayyip Erdogan attacking Ankara for buying Russian anti-aircraft missiles and for demanding that NATO treat its former Kurdish allies in Syria as terrorists.
I'm sorry to say that we don't have the same definition of terrorism around the table. When I look at Turkey, they now are fighting against those who fight with us, who fought with us, shoulder to shoulder against ISIS.
President Macron, how far then do these public airings of discontent suggest fundamental problems for NATO? Peter Ricketts is a former British ambassador to the alliance as well as British national security advisor.
I think that there have always been disagreements and arguments between NATO members. I served in NATO during the Cold War and there were some pretty deep disagreements then as well. One thing that I do note this time is that President Trump has come to London defending and speaking up for NATO, whereas a year ago, 2 years ago, he was advertising very clearly his scepticism about NATO. But there are some deep, deep disagreements, particularly with Turkey. And President Macron is never one to mince his words in public and has made that even clearer than other leaders publicly. This is not, as far as I can see, undermining the fundamental core purpose of NATO, which is to defend its members and to modernize itself to deal with new threats like cyber. But of course, it's part of the context of the meeting. And I hope that a little bit of frank talking and direct discussion between the principals over the next 24 hours may help to ease some of these tensions, in which case NATO is playing its role.
And yet, if you think about one of the very fundamental tenets of NATO, which is that there is a sense that an attack on one is an attack on all and that they've all got each other's backs. I mean, you very clearly don't get that sense from the sort of public airing of differences between France and Turkey and, to a certain extent, the United States. I mean, you say that President Trump has come full of praise for NATO. He also announced that the US gets far less out of NATO than member states such as France.
Sure. I mean, there are continuing difficulties and tensions like that. I agree. And just on what Turkey is blocking, as I understand it, there are a couple of effectively reinforcement plans that NATO has developed, one for the Baltic region, one for the southeastern part, in other words, reinforcement of Turkey, called graduated response plans. And as I understand it, Turkey is holding those up pending some agreement with other allies about whether one of these Turkish militia groups is a terrorist group or not. So, I mean, that's the kind of thing that happens in NATO. People take things hostage and hold on to them. I think it will eventually get sorted out, may not be over this summit, but I don't think that's a fundamental point. I think that's a bit of tactical maneuvering by President Erdogan. More fundamentally, of course, you can sense that the The countries near to Russia, the East Europeans, the Baltic states and so on, have a different set of priorities than countries like Turkey, facing the very difficult Middle East neighbourhood. And America is moving towards great power competition with China being perhaps its number one priority. So there are those sort of underlying trends which risk pulling NATO apart over time unless they are managed, unless the leaders can find a way of putting the emphasis on what brings us together and binds us together rather than what divides us.
Peter Rickett speaking there to my colleague Tim Franks. Well, while NATO leaders discuss global security, the United Nations is hosting its own meetings on the worldwide threat of climate change. To coincide with the two-week conference dubbed COP25, the UN's World Meteorological Organization has said that global temperatures continue to break records. Our environment correspondent Matt McGraw reports from the UN conference in Madrid.
In record temperatures, droughts and wildfires, the world has witnessed the sustained heating that has continued throughout 2019. It's been the hottest decade on record, but the scientists say it could have been a lot worse without the fact that much of the warming has been absorbed by the oceans. Claire Nullis is with the WMO.
The oceans are acting as a buffer at the moment. They're absorbing more than 90% of excess heat. As a result, they're becoming much more acidic. Even if we cut emissions, you know, it will take a long, long time for the oceans to recover from that.
The warming of the planet is also having a huge impact on humans. Medical experts from the UN consider climate change as potentially the biggest threat to human health in the 21st century. Dr. Maria Neira is with the World Health Organization.
The price of this climate crisis is paid more than anything else by our health, because our lungs, our brains, our cardiovascular system is very much suffering from the causes of climate change, which are overlapping very much with the causes of air pollution.
The latest data on temperatures was presented here in Madrid, where climate negotiators are trying to agree an adequate response. They'll soon be joined by the young Swedish activist, Greta Thunberg. She has sailed across the Atlantic from the US.
We need to work together to make sure that we secure future living conditions for humankind and that we fight for not only ourselves but for our children and for our grandchildren and for every single living being on Earth.
While her arrival will grab headlines, the real focus of this conference is on governments and whether they are willing to dramatically curb their carbon emissions. Right now, there is very little evidence that they will agree to do so.
Matt McGraw in Madrid, and we heard there also from Greta Thunberg, who's arrived in Lisbon on her way to Madrid. You're listening to the Global News Podcast on the BBC World Service. Still to come. A glimpse of utopia, North Korean style. But first to a man who's no stranger to controversy, the Tesla boss, Elon Musk. He's appeared in a California court to face defamation charges, having described the British man who led the Thai cave rescue in 2018 as a pedo guy. The specialist diver, Vernon Unsworth, is seeking compensation, but Mr. Musk claims that the phrase is a common insult and not an accusation of pedophilia. Our Los Angeles correspondent Sophie Long sent us this report just before we recorded this podcast.
Elon Musk is a resident here. He, of course, is an international businessman, one of the richest men in the world. But he arrived at this federal court building in Los Angeles. We think he could now just be starting to give his first testimony. Much of the morning here was taken up with jury selection, a long process during which the judge asked each juror a long list of questions, including whether they had strong opinions, negative or positive, on Elon Musk, and whether they had strong opinions on billionaires. When both legal teams were happy, we then heard the opening statements from each team. The first to go was Vernon Unsworth's lawyer, who set out his case and how he'd felt hurt and stressed and damaged by the tweets that you talk about. And then we heard from Elon Musk's lawyer, who told a very different story of the same sequence of events.
Sophie Long. Neuroscientists at the University of Bath here in the UK say they've made a breakthrough which could help with cures for a number of chronic diseases, including congestive heart failure and dementia. They've created artificial nerve cells that behave much like the real ones. Here's our science reporter, Helen Briggs.
Neurons or nerve cells are a type of cell that carries signals to and from the brain and the rest of the body. It's long been a goal to make artificial versions because of the hope of being able to treat diseases such as Alzheimer's, where neurons degenerate or die. A team from the University of Bath has managed to create artificial nerve cells with a combination of maths, computation and chip design. Professor Alan Nougaré, who led the project, describes the work as paradigm changing.
We can make synthetic brain cells that can be used to repair brain cells, biological brain cells, which are diseased in biological circuits in the brain. So we can engineer brain cells on a chip that can be used to repair diseased cells in the brain.
The long-term goal is to use the devices in medical implants that would replace damaged cells in the body. The team is already working on a smart heart pacemaker and hope to one day develop new treatments for dementia and epilepsy.
Helen Briggs. Now, it's official, at least according to state media in North Korea, utopia under socialism has been built. It comes in the shape of a new town in Samgye-yon County. State TV showed a long video of the opening ceremony with the TV presenter speaking enthusiastically as the Supreme Leader cut a red, red ribbon. So what does utopia under socialism actually look like? Alistair Coleman is BBC Monitoring's North Korea specialist.
It's not particularly large. It was getting quite run down. The most important thing about it is that it's a symbolism that it's all linked to the Kim family.
In what way?
Well, the whole of Samgye-yon County is close to Mount Paektu, which is sacred to the whole myth of Korean civilization. It's where Korean civilization took hold. But it is also the base where Kim Il-sung and his guerrillas fought against the Japanese occupation. And it is also supposedly on the very slopes there that Kim Jong-il was born, even though records show that he was actually born in the far east of Russia.
Can you tell me what it looks like now, or are we just sort of seeing plans? Is it finished?
They say they've finished the town, so there's been a lot of remodelling going on. It's a very communist thing, a very totalitarian country thing to build a model town or city somewhere to show off their prowess and the power over the country. So this is done. It's only a small town, but what they're going to do is actually, they say they're going to spruce up the whole of the county as well.
And are we talking about spanking new facilities? Are we just talking about nice new facades for existing blocks of flats? What sort of thing?
I think it's going to be pretty ambitious. I mean, there's things like creating a ski resort. They will modernise factories. They will modernise farms. And, you know, they're just going to make it a model county for the whole of North Korea to look at.
All of which sounds fantastic, but presumably costs a fair bit of money. And that's not something one associates North Korea as having a huge amount of.
No, but what they do have is an endless well of people power. Most of the building has been done by, I read in the report, Unit 217 of the Korean People's Army. And they're basically a construction unit that will go in and spend several months building a project and then leave. But there's also been so-called volunteers, which we presume may be akin to slave labour as well.
Is this with a sort of the target, the propaganda target of this, to be a source of inspiration for the people of North Korea, who, again, we tend to think of as living under, many of them living under considerable privations? Or is this something that's aimed at the outside world as saying sort of, look at us, you know, you may impose sanctions, but we can still do this?
It is a bit of both, yes. You've got it's for the internal audience. It's to show that things are going well. The Kim family knows what they're doing. Every great leap forward is a celebration. But for the outside world, what it's showing is that we can still do this despite your sanctions.
Alistair Coleman of BBC Monitoring talking to my colleague Tim Franks. Sex trafficking is one of the most misunderstood criminal activities in the United States. Many people assume the victims are trafficked in from abroad, but Department of Justice figures show that the vast majority of such women are American-born. Many are enslaved through drugs and branded with tattoos. But a project in Ohio is leading the way in the efforts to break the cycle of addiction, violence, and prostitution. Elaine Jung reports from the Ohio state capital, Columbus.
And so what you're basically saying is you want me to be your judge now.
Yes.
And guess what, I'm going to accept you.
This is Catch Court. It's an unconventional court and the brainchild of Judge Paul Herbert. He'd noticed that many women accused of prostitution were suffering from physical and psychological injuries and addictions caused by the men who controlled them.
It's supposed to be the world's oldest profession. So I believe that it's really the world's oldest oppression of women and girls and other vulnerable populations. You mix in physical and sexual violence, it's like prisoner of war tactics.
CATCH stands for Changing Actions to Change Habits. Women who are convicted of prostitution or crimes committed for their traffickers are redefined as victims and offered a route to recovery. They have to commit to a 2-year program, including probation, addiction treatment, and trauma therapy. They are given a job opportunity and must have no contact with their traffickers. Many traffickers brand their victims with a tattoo or scars to show who they belong to. Part of their recovery includes turning these brandings into new, inspiring tattoos. Holly was born into an abusive, dysfunctional family. Her problems got worse when she went to live with her mother, who had already been led into a life of dependency and prostitution.
I moved to Columbus when I was 15 to live with my real mother, which is like one of the worst decisions of my life, because within 2 weeks of being here in Columbus with my real mother, we were using drugs together. Within a month of being here in Columbus, we were prostituting together.
Holly was ensnared by another trafficker who abused her.
I had like this trauma bond to him. Like I felt like he took care of me, even though like he would beat me and then I'd go upstairs and go to sleep and I'd wake up to him raping me.
Holly's ordeal on the streets of Columbus lasted for 17 years. It only ended when she went to prison for drug possession and attended a counselling group. She wrote a letter to Catch Court pleading for help.
All I can say is any of us at any given time are here for you.
Women helping and healing each other is one of the program's strengths.
Friend, how are you?
Every Sunday, Holly and her sister Rosie, who is also a survivor of sex trafficking, hand out food and care packages to the women still selling themselves on the streets of Columbus.
That girl was maybe like 16 or 17. She didn't look very old.
Government figures show 80% of sex trafficking victims in the US are American-born. Sitting at a crossroads of many major interstate highways, Ohio has a disproportionately large number of them. I was given rare access to a child safe house, Grace Haven, which looks after girls as young as 12 who are victims of sex trafficking.
This bedroom looks like any girl's bedroom. This could have been my bedroom. What I find quite shocking is that there's a picture of an ultrasound. So there's a girl in here that's expecting.
Scott Arnold is executive director of Grace Haven.
The need, I think, is growing in dramatic ways, in part because we're rethinking what it means to be a sex trafficked young person. We used to think of this as something that kids chose or they did this because they had a drug habit. But as a community, we've begun to realize that's not true at all.
As many as 900 women from Columbus recently attended an event to celebrate the strength and resilience of sex trafficking survivors. As well as highlighting the scale of the problem, it also underlined the success of Catch Court. Less than 30% of graduates re-offend, compared to the national average of 80% for women convicted of such crimes. Other states are starting to follow Catch Court's lead. Holly is now a legal advocate for domestic violence victims and is considering doing a law degree.
I feel free now because I have the choice to make a decision in my life on where I move next. I never had that before. Like somebody was always controlling me like a puppet. And today, nobody controls me.
Holly ending that report from the BBC's Elaine Jung. To Kyrgyzstan, where the government has censored a feminist art exhibition over nudity. They've removed several exhibits from the women's rights show, saying they were provocative. More from our reporter, Krasimira Twig.
Well, this is a feminist art exhibition involving many artists from around the world, from 22 countries, and their various art performances. One of these performances is by a Danish artist who has well, gradually taken her clothes off in the exhibition hall in front of the visitors. And the point she's making is that sexual workers should be seen as human beings and as members of society rather than objects of desire.
So the exhibition has been censored. How has the government censored it?
Well, the culture minister called it a scandalous exhibition that used the language of provocation that was basically disorienting the visitors. And the director of the museum has been sacked. Now, she has posted the truth, as she calls it, on Facebook. And she says she has received threats for herself and other staff of the museum, as a result of which she has quit herself voluntarily.
It's not the kind of place, Kyrgyzstan, that you'd expect this type of exhibition to go down well, necessarily. So what was the aim of it?
So the aim of it was to highlight violence against women in Kyrgyzstan. And yes, this is very provocative because it's a mostly... It's a majority Muslim country. There are defenders of the traditional rights have been outraged and they have been very vocal about this kind of exhibition and have spoken out in strong terms against naked women parading under the excuse of feminism.
But clearly there must be some supporters as they managed to organize this exhibition. So what's the reaction been? Has there been any positive reaction?
There has been positive reaction. And in fact, the woman who had to quit has spoken at length about what needs to be done in the country. And she says this is our unconventional fight, which may be difficult to swallow, but it's a way to fight for women's rights in this country. And art, she says, has a purpose, even if it's shocking. In fact, she has received support from others. For example, former Kyrgyz president Roza Otunbayeva spoke condemning the decision to sack her and spoke in favor of this kind of art. And she said, "Stop, gentlemen. This is how some people are fighting against violence against women. What have you in government done to solve this problem?"
Krasimira Twig. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. And if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Emilio San Pedro. Until next time, goodbye.